Hi, Dave Emmer here. This is For the Record program number 1332, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 6, and this is being recorded on June 22nd of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Monty, my new co-host. And, you know, I almost feel like another participant in the broadcast, even though he has long shuffled off this mortal coil, and that is Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, who, what a resume. I mean, you talk about a master traitor. He is fundamentally involved as a secret speech agent with, the handover of Czechoslovakia to Hitler. And by the way, we should note that one of the things that Hitler got through his acquisition of Czechoslovakia was control over the Škoda Arms Works, it's S-K-O-D-A, and that was one of the many properties of Max Egan von Hohenlohe. He was a primary, I don't know if he owned it, but a primary operative of Škoda, a major munitions manufacturer with an interlocking directorate with Schneider Cruzo, that's S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R hyphen Cruzo, C-R-E-U-S-O-T, a major French munitions maker. Then we've got von Hohenlohe in early 43 committing treason. Well, Alan Dulles was committing treason. Von Hohenlohe was doing his thing. But in the negotiations with which we began, for the record, 1327, and he's acting, von Hohenlohe is, as an agent for, cat's paw for, Walter Schellenberg, who is in charge of foreign intelligence for the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD, that's Sam Donald, the SS Intelligence Service. And then we've got him networking with Wynne Scott, working for the OSS, then working with Wynne Scott for the, was it the SCU? Was that the name of the pre-CIA, CIA between the World War, just after World War II, Monty?
Yeah, that's, the SSU, the Strategic Services Unit.
Okay, SSU, not SCU. SSU in the immediate post-World War II period. And right. Then we've got von Hohenlohe identified by Colonel Ray Rocha, the Deputy Chief of Cavalry Intelligence for James Jesus Angleton, as apparently the Nazi being referred to by Carlos Bringer and Mr. De Pina, and someone being pursued legally and from an investigative standpoint by Jim Garrison. So von Hohenlohe is a person, it's not a name one hears very often, but it is a name deeply embedded in the most pivotal events of the last century and also some of the bloodiest. So truly a remarkable individual, and again, his connections with Sofindus, all the capitals, S-O-F. I-N-D-U-S, should not be overlooked at all. So, Monty, you want to continue with the reading from the book that you were reading from when we left off at 1331?
Absolutely. And as an annotation to what you just said, which was excellent, thank you for that. What Hohenlohe was doing, Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, what he was doing for Skopta Werks, he was essentially acting as a contractor. You know? So he was in one sense, a purchasing agent for Hermann Göring's four-year plan through the Sofindus networks in Spain. But in a very real sense, he was a purchasing agent for Skopta Werks. You know, he was securing military contracts for them through Switzerland, of all places.
And again, von Hohenlohe is a member via marriage of the Habsburg dynasty. And if all this sounds, you know, weird, incomprehensible, one of the foundational elements here is the role of the European aristocracies in fascism and the links between the Spanish aristocracy and those of Latin America. Again, you've got Hohenlohe part of the Habsburg family in Spain, working also in the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia, helping to sell those out to Neville Chamberlain, to Hitler, networking with Neville Chamberlain in this regard. But Cinco de Mayo here in California, it is a holiday that celebrates the Battle of Puebla.
That's and correct.
That was when Prince Maximilian of, quote, France, unquote, was defeated, and ultimately he was executed by a Mexican firing squad. But his full name was Prince Maximilian von Habsburg. He was a member of the Habsburg family. So when we see Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe working as a top agent of CIA in Mexico, and in turn networking with Wynn Scott, with whom he'd been networking for a long time. And also, through Wynn Scott, we've got Los Pecos working as a propaganda arm of CIA in Mexico City. All of this is, again, a derivative of what I called in our first program the sweep of history, which you have been filling in for us. So please, go ahead, Marty.
Thank you. On that note, David, to answer your question from the previous program about the Free Austria movement set up by Count Lindemann in Czechoslovakia.
Yes.
And in it being an anti-Nazi movement, I'd like to quote directly from I've quoted from this document before, the British National Security Archives for Covert Action. And then this is document nomenclature KV2/3289. Reading again, this is document reference British National Security National Archives. Excuse me. KV2/3289. And this is page 22 of this 57-page dossier. This is a British intelligence dossier on Hohenlohe, all right? And this is a MI5 dossier, as a point of fact, on page 22. And I'll read it in its entirety, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
So this is Purple Primer Record, Purple Primer being a code prefix for MI5 records on SD operatives. And it's reading from top to bottom. It starts, Prince, quote, Prince Max Egan Marie Edwin Paul Hohenlohe Langenberg, Lichtschilder of Czech origin. And it talks about a little bit of his background. I'll skip through that. It says, between 1938 and 1939, he was an important part of the Sudeten separatist movement, acting as a host to Lord Grumegan during the negotiations. Reported to have been at that time very close to Reich Marshal Hermann Göring and to Heinrich Himmler, and he was rewarded for his undercover aid to the Nazis by membership of the board to Stokta Verne Works, a Czech munitions works, from which he subsequently represented Spain as Consiglier Delgado. That's his code name, working under Sokoverks in Spain.
So Consigliere Delgado was his code name while working for Skoda in Spain. Go ahead.
and that job was actually a payout for pulling the wool over Neville Chamberlain's eyes. You know, so it's actually, you know, one hand washing the other here. Continuing. Reported February 1943 to be employed by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, who was chief of Abwehramt, for a high-level diplomatic and social penetration of Western intelligence. Meaning that when Hohenlohe makes his contact with Alan Dulles in Switzerland, it is not a friendly concession. He is, in fact, acting as a spy penetrating Western intelligence. Continuing. Reported in 1943 to have been sent to Portugal by Himmler to win over the Spanish monarchists in their support of Germany, posed with the British as an anti-Nazi, but was reported in June of 1944 to be an important agent of the SD with the rank of SS Obergruppenführer.
Hohenlohe was
a general in the SS.
I was going to say, doesn't that mean general?
Yes.
My late dear friend Mabel, I can't say this on the air, but oh my Aiken A blank blank. Go ahead.
Reading again, reported in June of 1944 to be an important agent of the SS. Reported January 1945 to be connected with the so-called anti-Nazi Free Austrian Group, which is suspected in reality to be a secret Nazi intelligence organization controlled by Walter Schellenberg.
Again, in charge of foreign intelligence for the SD, the SS Intelligence Service.
Also, Schellenberg, from 1941 to the end of the war, was the head of all Waffen-SS Einsatzgruppen on the Eastern Front. So he was, in fact, commander of all mobile death squads on the Eastern Front.
And those mobile death squads became a key function of the Gehlen Organization, the Office for Policy Coordination, and later the full-fledged CIA.
Correct. So, what are the three important things that we could pull from this, and I should know, end quote on that. What are the three important, things that we could pull from this, MI6, MI5, background on Holonoi? Well, one, he is in fact a full-fledged operative in the SD, and he is a general in the SS. The second thing is that his anti-Nazi Free Austrian organization is in fact a front for Schellenberg to penetrate Western intelligence. And in February of 1943, when he visited Alan Dulles for the famous Bull Pauls meetings that were reported by Fred J. Cook in 1961, those meetings were in fact a covert penetration of Western intelligence on the orders of Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, head of German intelligence for the Nazi Party.
So Canaris would, one question I have. What were the hierarchical positions of Schellenberg and Canaris in this? Because Canaris eventually was executed, after the attempt on Hitler's life. What was the hierarchical relationship between Canaris and Schellenberg here?
Well, that's interesting. Canaris and Schellenberg had been friends since 1919. They used to go on horseback rides together. They went on hunting expeditions together. They had a very close personal relationship. So, after, Reinhard Heydrich is assassinated, the head of the Reich's main security command, and Ernst Kantenbrunner takes his place, Schellenberg, in fact, has a very close ad hoc relationship with Canaris that goes all the way back, at least a full decade before the Nazis even come to power. It's a very interesting relationship that these two men have.
Oh, okay, thank you, because, again, it's just watching this sweep of history, this may seem to some listeners like we're going out on a limb or a tangent, or this is some sort of peripheral digression, but von Hohenlohe is at the very epicenter of international power politics, a man who helped to engineer with Neville Chamberlain, who I've never accepted that he was the dupe he's been presented as being. I think he was more an agent of Mobbegan Norman and Imperial Chemicals, and only too willing to be, quote, deceived, unquote, by the likes of von Hohenlohe. But we've got him networking with Neville Chamberlain in the handover of Czechoslovakia to Hitler. Then we've got him networking with Alan Dulles, who was basically committing treason against the U.S., not for the last time, in early 1943. We've got him networking with Wynne Scott of the OSS during the war, networking with Wynne Scott of the SSU after the war. Then we've got him participating, apparently, according to the inquiries of the late Ray Rocha, in the assassination of JFK, or at least being part of that milieu in Mexico City, networking once again with CIA station chief Wynne Scott. And in turn, Wynne Scott is using Los Tecos as a propaganda front, Los Tecos being the Mexican Nazi movement, and you know, for people today, particularly young people, wondering all about all the discussion of the migrants, quote unquote, at the southern border, you know, at least part of the problem is what the U.S. did in Central America in the 1980s and 1990s, particularly in the 80s, and the death squads that literally laid waste to vast amounts of the Central American polity are among the reasons why those, quote, migrants, unquote, are coming to the southern U.S. border. And the discussions that we have had about Max Egan von Hohenlohe are inextricably linked with the dynamics presented in AFA program number 16 from March of 1986, because Los Pecos are inextricably linked with the coalescence of the Latin American death squads that were commanded by the likes, well, that operated on behalf of the likes of George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, et al., and in part laid waste to Central America, and in part, there's more to it than this, but in part bear responsibility for the, quote, migrants, unquote, quote, storming, unquote, our southern border. Go ahead, Moppy.
Correct, correct. And I should note, just as a personal annotation from the research I've been doing on the Kennedy assassination, when the first CAL, you know, Latin American Anti-Communist Confederation, is established in 1955, the American representative to that organization was E. Howard Hunt.
Oh, later, of course, involved with Watergate, and also a person whose name crops up in connection with the Kennedy assassination in many ways. And before that, and eventually in future discussions, we'll be talking about matters Japanese and the U.S. prosecution of the Cold War in Asia, in which essentially the same dynamics are manifest. We basically took in, we networked, we rearmed all of the fascists, basically took them in. We've had General Arisu, the Japanese Galen, and we'll talk all about what happened in Asia during the Cold War. But E. Howard Hunt was very much involved with the recrudescence, the resuscitation of Japanese fascism.
Yes, it's you know, once again, just as a personal annotation and the research I've done about E. Howard Hunt, and I don't have the document in front of me yet, but we will get to that in a future program, as you said. It should be noted that E. Howard Hunt, between 1954 and 1958, he was the chief of covert action at the Tokyo station for the CIA in Japan. So just let that sit in for a moment, you know.
And we'll do more than just let it sit in future programs. Go ahead, Mike.
Right. Future programs. Yeah, we'll cover Hunt's connection with the Asian People's Anti-Communist League and his overlap into CAL and the Los Tecos Nazis in a future program for sure.
Okay, now back to Max von Egan von Hohenlohe and
So reading again from the book is The Go-Betweens for Hitler by Karina Urbach, last name U-R-B-A-C-H. And this is published by Oxford University Press. So I'm on Chapter 6, which is picking up where I left off. Chapter 6, Munich to Marbella. And this is page 287, continuing with Hohenlohe pulling the wool over British intelligence's eyes. Reading page 287. Hitler knew about and had supported the Weidmann Stephanie Hohenlohe channel to Halifax, and probably knew that Goering was running another back channel in Czechoslovakia. To this day, his actions in the summer of 1938 puzzle historians. He seemed determined to carry out his Case Green attack on Czechoslovakia. But he also had periods of doubt. He was not sure how the British would react, and it was therefore important for him to get as much information via go-betweens as possible. Consequently, people like Max Hohenlohe were extremely useful. In July of 1938, the moderate German Holonoy therefore came to London and explained to the Foreign Office contacts that Hitler was bound to start a war over Czechoslovakia and that Helene indeed needed to support so this could be avoided.
Bobby, I have a question. I just wanted to interrupt briefly. There was a reference in that text to Stephanie von Hohenlohe, Max von Hohenlohe's sister. Right. And also, Wiedemann, was that Fritz Wiedemann?
Correct.
And he was he not the Nazi consul in San Francisco and a key Nazi agent, not only in the U.S., but specifically on the West Coast and the San Francisco Bay Area in particular?
Correct. Wiedemann had a deputy who was the German general consul in Los Angeles, specifically by the name of Gregor Giesling. And Giesling was, in fact, a Sinkdirektdienst operative who was liaisoning directly with the Silver Shirt Legion attachés in Los Angeles, who were in turn were mobilizing several unions representing Mexican expats that were in turn being weaponized by the Mexican Nazi Party, at that time known as the Mexican Revolutionary Action Party or the Silver Shirts.
The Mexicans were the Gold Shirts, and William
the Americans were the Silver Shirts, correct.
That was William Dudley Pelley's group.
Right. And the Gold Shirts were, in fact, being supported by an American oilman by the name of William Davies.
William Rhodes Davis.
Correct.
Who ultimately appears to have been assassinated by William Stevenson. But what's very interesting, well, there are a lot of things interesting about William Rhodes Davis, but he was working with J. Paul Getty, the patriarch of the Getty family, who was a personal friend of Adolf Hitler's, by the way, and also was shipping oil illegally to Franco and the Third Reich. So when you hear about the Getty family and the very prestigious and non-politically connected Getty museums, it is the family of J. Paul Getty, who was a friend of Hitler and a business partner illegally with not only Hitler, but William Rhodes Davis. Go ahead, Marty.
Right. And of course, just to backtrack on that, William Rhodes Davis was, by all accounts, the top finance officer for the Mexican Nazi Party, which eventually consolidated itself into Los Tecos, which in 1963 is, in fact, the top propaganda and covert action arm of Winston McKinley Scott's CIA station in Mexico City, where Max Egan von Hohenlohe is a principal agent for covert action and propaganda.
One very big and at least in terms of their own dynamics, one very big happy family.
And also, make no mistake, that when Gregor Giesling was kicked out of the, just once again as an aside to the research I'm working off the Kennedy assassination, when Giesling was kicked out of the Los Angeles embassy in 1943, Heinrich Himmler made him a personal attaché to Friedrich Schwend, the commander of Operation Bernhardt. So just let that sit in for a moment, you know?
Bernhard is a program or five in and of itself. Go ahead.
Right. So continuing with the go-betweens for Hitler by Karina Urbach, page 287, chapter 6, quote, Hohenlohe also portrayed Goering as a man in Hitler's entourage who was eager to find a peaceful solution. The British listened carefully. By then, they had come to the conclusion that a British arbiter should be involved. Chamberlain and Halifax had the right candidate for this endeavor, the 68-year-old Lord Runciman. Runciman.
How's that spelled, Moppy?
That's the R-U-N-C-I-M-A-N.
Okay, go ahead.
Runciman was seen as a safe pair of hands. Quote, he could be relied upon to put the results across. His background, political career, and establishment credentials left him naturally capable of knowing exactly how London would wish to act. To the public, Runciman was sold as an independent, end quote. The Runciman mission to Czechoslovakia lasted from 3 August to 16 September 1938. During his visit, he talked to the Czech President Beneš, Prime Minister Hoca, and the leader of the Studenten Party, Henlen. In this fact-finding mission, Runciman was supported by Holonoy. Max Holonoy seemed a genuine mediator to him because he was trusted by Hoca and Hillman. It was Holonoy who brought Runciman and Hillman together for their castle, to his castle for talks. He volunteered as a translator, and after the meeting remained the link between the two men. Runciman was not alone in the reconnaissance trip, but accompanied by Ashton Gwatrick of the Foreign Office. Ashton Gwatrick came to the obvious conclusion that Holonoy and his fellow Studenten German aristocrats were strong supporters of the SDP, the Studenten German Party, and were personally fond of the chicken, Helen. Ideally, this revelation should have led Ashton Galkin and Russemann to find out more about the other side of the argument. Yet, the Studenten Germans tried their best to prevent this. Holonoy invited all of his pervasive aristocratic friends to charm Runciman. The historian Egil Glasheim, last name spelled G-L-A-S-S-H-E-I-M, has shown how well this succeeded. Quote, during the 6-week stay in Czechoslovakia, Runciman spent all but 1 weekend as a guest of the Bohemian nobles. He ate lavish dinners with them, shot patriots at their estate, and toured the countryside in their mortar cars. It was a cross-country house-style entertainment from which Russemann felt thoroughly at home with. Holonoy introduced him to the best families in the region, the Klinskys, the Claire Adabrins, and the Westphalis. The agenda behind this was so obvious that it was already criticized at the time. The Daily Express saw the closeness of the Runciman to Holonoy and to his friends as inappropriate, especially after the Studenten Germans kept rejecting the Czech offers. Until now, and this is a quote from the Daily Express, July 1938, until now, Lloyd Runciman had dealt in his talks only with Hillman's lieutenants. This meeting with all the Czech newspapers carrying attacks on the Studentens for turning down the government's offer yesterday of partial home rule, he and Lady Russemann sent for their car and set out for Holonoy's castle. The prince, Max Holonoy, who is a Liechtenstein subject and a close Nazi sympathizer, was waiting for them, end quote. Times of London claimed that Stephanie Holonoy had joined Max and Runciman in Czechoslovakia. Stephanie always denied having been a part of the Runciman entertainment group. For once, she might have been honest. She was probably too exposed after the press caught her and Vitamin leaving Halifax's house in July of 1938. That Holonoy could work so well on the British was also to some extent the fault of the Czech government. They did not seize the chance to impress Russemann. This is more surprising since the Czech president, Beneš, was offered help by the Czech mind aristocrats who wanted to entertain Russemann. Beneš did not take them up on their offer and lost the hospitable race. But he did try to solve the Studenten question. On 4 September, he declared that he would fulfill his demands with Henlen he had made. Hitler was not interested. Instead, he ordered incidents to be organized against the suppressed Studenten Germans and enable him to raise his demands.
In other words, the incidents being false flag operations, basically.
Correct.
Provocations. Go ahead.
Correct. And just as an aside, and I don't have my references in front of me, it should be noted that the man that staged the Gleisewitz radio incident, which is a false flag attack that allowed the Germans to invade Poland, a man by the name of Narjaks, Alfred Narjaks, who was a colonel in the Waffen-SS and a close personal attaché in 1939, of Reinhard Heydrich, the head of the SD and the Reich's main security command. It should be noted that Alfred Narjaks was, in fact, the man that was in charge of the false flag attacks in the Sudetenland as well. And later on in 1941, Narjox was the original commander of Operation Bernhardt before Bernhard Kruger and Friedrich Schwen took over. So just as a historical aside, look how all of those entities overlap with each other into the Holonoi operations with the Free Austrian Movement. I mean, it's fascinating how all of these entities overlap with each other.
It is very quickly. Operation Bernhardt, of course, was the forging of British pound notes and also American currency to undermine both the British and American war economies. And also, the operation provided funding for the Nazi diaspora and the rat lines. Go ahead, Marty.
Correct. once again, we will get to this in a later program about Japanese intelligence and their connections to Alan Dulles. But it should be noted real quick that the top purchasing agent for the Bank of International Settlements, who was in fact purchasing the bulk of the British sterling pound notes that were counterfeited by Operation Bernhardt, was the Japanese administrator for the Bank of International Settlements at that time, an admiral in the Japanese Navy by the name of Yoshiro Fukujima, last name spelled F-U-G-I-M-U-R-A. Reading again, Yoshiro Fukujima. And Admiral Fukujima later became the Japanese intelligence attaché to Carl Wolf during Carl Wolf's surrender to Alan Dulles under Operation Sunrise. And we'll talk about that in a later program.
Oh, yeah. By the way, there is a good essay. You could get it online, but by the brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Dale Scott, called How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other. And there's good discussion of Operation Sunrise in that. And but also, I did a program called Darkness at Sunrise, all about Operation Sunrise. Go ahead, Moppy.
Right. So continuing with the go-betweens for Hitler, once again on page 289. Oh, for Pete's sake, I lost my place. Oh, excuse me, page 288, continuing. In the meantime, Holonoi continued to work on Rumison. To drum the point home that the Sudeten Germans were suffering under the Czech regime, Holonoi's friend Count Kinzig, last name spelled K-I-N-S-K-Y, Kinzig, even gave Rumison a tour of some of Sudetenland's more rundown areas. In a secret report to the Foreign Office, an informant noted that Kinzig's tour utterly misrepresented the real conditions. Rumison had on purpose been shown the dirtiest smelters and the worst houses in the area, indicating that the Czech government did not in fact care about their peoples. He may not have noticed that he was being manipulated, but his wife certainly did not. Hilda Rumison, herself a politician, accompanied her husband to Czechoslovakia and was worked on by the female Sudeten German aristocrats. One of her hostesses showed her a prized autographed picture of Hitler and marveled about his achievements. Hilda Rumison noted in her journal, quote, "All this doesn't sound like a man who is eager to take over all of Europe, which so many people persistently believe," end quote. Chamberlain would have agreed with her analysis, even though her other messages were reaching him by now, urging him not to give in to Hitler. The anti-Nazi Germans begged the British to help them with the Czechs. They quite rightfully pointed out that the German generals were doubtful whether or not a war against Czechoslovakia could be won. This fear should be used to topple Hitler, but Chamberlain simply dismissed such arguments. Once again, it should be noted that Chamberlain was, in fact, a protege of Montagu Norman, who was a financial supporter of the Third Reich very early on. So, consider his motivations there.
And also, he was a major investor in Imperial Chemicals, which was a cartel partner of IG Farben. So he had, he literally had skin in the game here.
Reading again. But Chamberlain simply dismissed such arguments. Instead, he announced that he would negotiate with Hitler in Berchtesgaden. Rumison was ordered to leave Prague and come to London. But when he arrived in Downing Street, he gave an ambivalent report. Chamberlain ignored the report in its entirety. He told the House of Commons on 28 September a different story. Quote, this is Chamberlain speaking. The cabinet met, and it was attended by Lord Rumison, who at my request had also traveled to Prague on the same day. Lord Rumison informed us that although in his view the responsibility for the final breach in negotiations at Prague rested with the Studenten extremists, nevertheless, in view of the recent development, the frontier districts between Czechoslovakia and Germany, where the Studenten population was in an important majority, should be given the full right of self-determination at once. He considered the secession of territory to be inevitable and thought it should be done promptly, end quote. So, you know, in a sense, Chamberlain ignored all of the reports from Rumison and Rumison's wife, and went along with Holonoy's program. So he towed the Nazi party line, Neville Chamberlain, in Czechoslovakia.
Not surprising. Go ahead, Marty.
Continuing. This was not what Rumison had said. Despite all the pressure of Holonoy and his associates, Rumison still seems to have had his doubts. In the end, Chamberlain manipulated Rumison into writing the report that was friendly to Holonoy. The American journalist Dorothy Thompson was already describing it as a rigged report. In fact, Rumison's first draft seems to have been cut and pasted, adapted to suit Hitler and Chamberlain. The Rumison report should in fact have been called the Chamberlain report, or more appropriately, the Holonoy report.
I was going to say, I could think of a more appropriate name. Go ahead.
Tapped Czech telephone conversations indicate that Rumison had been overruled by the prime minister. Yet at the end of the day, he bears the responsibility because he did not stand up and air his doubts. His loyalty to Chamberlain, and in some ways, perhaps to the Studenten Germans host, was greater. In the meantime, Holonoy's pro-Studenten German activities did not go unannounced In the meantime, Holonoy's pro-Studenten German activities did not go unnoticed by the Czech government. He became a victim of reprisals. When Hitler and Chamberlain were working out the Munich Agreement that would seal the fate of Czechoslovakia, Holonoy's castle was being pillaged. Holonoy's British protector, Sir Robert Vanstret, tried to help him. Quote, and this is Vanstret speaking. Prince Max Holonoy had just told me that he had the news that his castle was being pillaged and the contents removed. In view of all that he has done recently by way of mediation for the Czech Studenten question, I feel that at least I can do is ask you to make an appeal to the Czech authorities to stop this, and I shall be very grateful you to put in a word on Holonoy's behalf as soon as possible.
I guess we could call this a Habsburg and Sicherheit speech version of Better Homes and Gardens.
Right. Continuing. It turned out that Holonoy did not need help in regarding his castle, though. A day after Vanstert's note on 30 September, the fear of Czech reprisals was over once and for all. The Studentenland and Holonoy's castle now belong, thanks to the Munich Agreement set up by Chamberlain, to Germany. The German army marched into Studentenland and took over all of the Czech fortifications. From then on, it was only a matter of time before they seized the whole of Czechoslovakia. After the Munich Agreement, Rumison and Holonoy stayed friends. In 1939, they visited Hermann Göring together in his country seat in Carnenhall. It probably never occurred to Rumison that his charming friends, Reich Marshal Göring and Prince Holonoy, had played him during the Studenten crisis. The Munich Agreement was not just a great victory for Göring and Hitler, it was a great victory for the go-betweens. As we have seen, Stephanie Holonoy congratulated Hitler enthusiastically on his completion, thereby celebrating herself a little too much. It was also a great victory for her fellow go-between, Max Holonoy. He received recognition for his help in many different ways. One was financially. According to the files of the British Security Services, files of which I've already quoted before, reading again, according to the files of British Security Services, Max Holonoy was reported to have been rewarded for his undercover aid as a general in the SS by the Nazis with membership on the board of Sockdabrunn, the Czech munitions work, from which he subsequently represented in Spain.
And that is the Schuller works that we've been talking about intermittently.
Right. This is, just to put it in historical context, all of the tanks that were used during the invasion of Poland were in fact built exclusively by Stokowerks under contracts controlled by Max Egan von Holonoy.
It's hard to listen to this and not use words that I can't use on the radio. One of the many things, thinking about this, you've got these high-rolling Brits, frankly, diplomats, nobles, others, Lord Halifax, Neville Chamberlain, and they're schmoozing with, emissaries of Hermann Göring, or in some cases, with Hermann Göring himself, and it was Hermann Göring's Luftwaffe that was to rain bombs and destruction and death on British cities during the Battle of Britain, London, Coventry, so many other cities. And when one thinks about the British citizens who were sitting under the German bombs, being commanded, the aircraft dropping those bombs being commanded by the very same Hermann Göring, who's glad-handing around British power elite who helped to hand over Czechoslovakia to Hitler, and a central element, a fundamental element in that is the very same SS general, Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe, an in-law of the Habsburg family. Go ahead, Marty.
Correct. And to put that into further historical context for your listening audience, consider this for a moment what we're saying. The top asset, the primary intelligence agent, the top cutout for the CIA station in Mexico City was also the man that oversaw all of the contracts that built the tanks that invaded Poland. Consider that for a moment in the proper historical context. A mass murdering psychopath was the CIA's top operative in Mexico City in 1963.
Something else to think about, too, is that the Nazis did not have enough tetraethyl lead for their invasion of Poland.
Right.
So Brown Brothers Harriman shipped them, I don't know how many tons, so they could keep up with their invasion timetable of Poland. And Averill Harriman was the top dog, and I use the term advisedly, in Brown Brothers Harriman. And Joe Biden is a protege of Averill Harriman. So when we see what Joe Biden is doing in Ukraine, and we'll come to Ukraine, if not in this broadcast, in our next, the apples don't fall too far from the tree. Go ahead, Nobby.
No, sir. Continuing. The Waffen Union Sockdabrunn was an armaments trust that the Nazis had set up in 1940 in Spain. Holonoy later represented Sockdabrunn in Spain as well. According to Spitzi, Holonoy explained to him that Spain was useful for business, and at the time, business was a good cover for peace work with the West. It was also his wife's home, and he could entertain there in style. As a point of fact, Holonoy's wife had a 40-room mansion in Madrid all throughout the Second World War.
Well, that's a nice cozy little starter home, I guess.
Continuing, Holonoy had done well out of the Sudeten crisis. Czech aristocrats, who had shown solidarity with the Czech government, on the other hand, were less lucky. They were outraged by the betrayal of Czechoslovakia. However, they would not be rewarded for their rectitude. After suffering reprisals under the Nazi regime, in 1948, the new communist rulers made sure that they lost all of their remaining property. With his Sudeten German mission over, Holonoy's next moves became even murkier. He continued to travel widely, so it is difficult to follow his tracks. But he was in the United States in 1942. Since FBI files had not been released, we cannot verify what exactly he was doing there, apart from sorting out his wife's business interests. Consider that for a moment, listening audience. The FBI to this day will not release what the hell a general in the SS was doing in the United States.
Well, and that was after Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. I'm still processing, you know, well, Poland today is aligned, obviously, it's become a NATO member, and Western Ukraine, or Galicia, which was the most pro-Nazi part of Ukraine, it had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Austro-Hungarian Empire, and that was the overall aristocratic umbrella, so to speak, for Max Egan von Hohenlohe. But correct. When one thinks about the Nazi tanks that stormed into Poland and the absolute horrors that were visited upon the Polish population, Jewish and non-Jewish as well, and it was Skobeverks and Max von Hohenlohe that specifically built those tanks that rolled over the Polish border at Gliwice, courtesy of Mr. Nowak's and Operation Canned Meat, as it was called. Really, for Max Egan von Hohenlohe, his treason with Alan Dulles in early 43, or his treason with Wim Scott and, by extension, Alan Dulles in Mexico in 1963, that was literally business as usual for him.
Oh, absolutely. Once again, as a historical aside, and we'll get into this in a later program when we talk about the Kuomintang connections to the Japanese fascists, it should be noted that during the invasion of Poland, one of the forward tank commanders, who actually was at the, according to all historical accounts, was the commander of the head tank during the invasion of Poland, was Chiang Kai-shek's son.
I knew he'd served in the Wehrmacht, but, the head of the Reichswehr, the German army between the World Wars, at one point was General Hans von Seeckt, and he was also someone who helped to command Chiang Kai-shek's forces, battling Mao Zedong's communists in, the Chinese Civil War before the, after the Japanese invaded Manchuria, but before the outbreak of the Sino-Japanese War in 37-38, which then morphed directly into World War II.
Right, right. he was actually a captain in the Wehrmacht, within their armored divisions, and his name was Chang Wei Ko, last name spelled W-E-I hyphen K-U-O. Chang Wei Ko, the adopted son of Chiang Kai-shek, was a participant and the forward tank commander for the invasion of Poland.
That is wild. And by the way, I talked about the narco-fascism of Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang. And for the record, shows 1195 through 1214, a long, long series. And we'll be coming back to those dynamics in future shows. Go ahead, Monty.
Absolutely. So continuing with the go-betweens for Hitler. Once again, this is page 291, chapter 6, Munich to Mybella, continuing. Since Hohenlohe worked for Goering, it is highly probable that in the summer of 1939, he was involved in preparations for the proposed Goering visit to Britain. This visit was planned for August of 1939 and, of course, never took place. Whether it was ever seriously contemplated by the Germans is unclear. Most probably, it was an avenue Hitler left open for himself. Yet the visit was one of many reasons why the British government did not see the Nazi-Soviet pact coming. The Foreign Office firmly believed that Hitler, deeply ideological, would never negotiate seriously with the Soviet Union. When the pact was signed, it sent shockwaves through Whitehall. They were not the only ones surprised. The pact must have irritated Holonoy as well. He had not been privy to such secret negotiations and must have been confused. Since generally unprincipled on Holonoy was a principled anti-Bolshevik, he too must have found the pact a hard swallow. Worse to come, after Germany invaded Poland and Britain declared war in September 1939, Holonoy appeared badly informed to his German employers. Up to the outbreak of the war, he had always argued that an understanding with the British was possible. In September of 1939, he had to adjust overnight. After the war, he claimed that he went on the offensive and wrote a forceful memoranda to Goering, and this is Holonoy speaking, quote, "In initiating World War II, Germany had stated from false premises and miscalculated in every way. She did not calculate that England and France would fight for Poland, overlooking the fact that Poland is not point. It is something quite different, the maintenance and assurance of peace in Europe. Even at this late stage, the possibility of an overall solution must be borne in mind. It must include the reestablishment of confidence, a guarantee for the respective treaties, disarmament under mutual control, and possibly withdrawal from Czechoslovakia and its reconstruction as a demilitarized state," end quote. The journalist Heinz Hone believed that this document to be genuine, but it could be backdated or is a fake. Still, it points to something Holonoy did next. He did work as a go-between again and bring about nothing less than a peace deal with Britain. He was not the only seasoned go-between who had such an idea. As we have seen, Stephanie Holonoy hoped to pull off a similar coup from an American hotel room using an intelligence officer, Wiseman. Their ambition did not seem misplaced. Both Holonoys had been successful before, and they thought of themselves as much more effective than diplomats. After all, back channels had been useful throughout the 1930s, so why not now? Indeed, with the outbreak of the war, people like Max Holonoy became important again. What happened next was reminiscent of the aristocratic peace feelers of the First World War. Since Britain and Germany could not talk to each other officially, they needed trusted go-betweens. Another reason why go-betweens were listed as a great, Another reason why go-betweens were listened to was the great insecurity within the British government. The hope was that some kind of understanding with Germany, though not necessarily with Hitler, could still be found, was not given up overnight. Holonoy understood this. He knew the psychology of Chamberlain Circle well. He wanted to talk to somebody who could understand a moderate, quote, conservative German, end quote. And he offered them such an option. His idea was to keep the conversation with the British going by creating the illusion of an alternative Christian West for Germany. He therefore stressed in the first conversations after the outbreak of the war that opposition to Hitler and that this opposition might be able to end the war. According to Holonoy, Goering was a proponent of this Christian West alternative as a leader. Today, we know that an opposition to Hitler did not exist and would form later again in the war. Yet Goering was a decoy. He had been advised a more cautious route before the war. After Hitler's overwhelming successes, he never seriously thought of challenging the Fuhrer's position. This does not mean that Goering did not want to try peace feelers, but he was most probably with Hitler's approval and did not intend to overthrow Hitler. Hermann Goering did just for Hitler what he had always done. He made the use of his go-betweens. The most famous go-between after the outbreak of the war was his friend, the Swedish businessman Dolores, who kept pestering the British. But Goering also used Max Holonoy, who at this point was still trusted by the British. That Goering thought he could be successful with peace feelers was not unrealistic. Though the Chamberlain government had failed appeasement policy, British was still in a state of phony war between Germany. Between the outbreak of the war in September 1939 and the summer of 1940, there were several British appeasers who wanted to end the war. Polonoi and the Nazi leadership were informed about a group of people by the Duke of Alba. I should note once again that the Duke of Alba is mentioned inside of the British intelligence documents that I mentioned before concerning Sofindis as being a top deputy to Polonoi in his Sofindis operations. So here is a second Sofindis operative mentioned inside of this account. Continuing.
Well, Mother, we've got less than 5 minutes left, so go ahead. But be aware of that, though. Go ahead.
Alba was a Spanish ambassador to Britain. He supported Francisco Franco, was pro-German, and thoroughly anti-Semitic and anti-Bolshevik. He was connected to the British aristocracy through the Marlboroughs, the Churchill family. His diplomatic status gave him access to the British government, but because of this perfect pedigree, he also had access to the British establishment in general, including key peers to the House of Lords. What he was hearing from his friends in the House of Lords in February 1940 encouraged him. They were very much hoping to come to an understanding of Hitler and agreed to put pressure on Chamberlain. Alba informed the Spanish Foreign Ministry in a secret report about this meeting. The report was passed on to the German embassy in Madrid. Reading it must have given considerable pleasure to the Germans. End quote. So, ending right there with the account by Karina Urbach, the go-betweens for Hitler, David, and listening audience, it has to be appreciated that Duke Alba of Spain, who was the head of the German attaché through the Spanish embassy to Britain, was in fact the intelligence agent within Sofindis that establishes the connections to Alan Dulles in Switzerland through the Spanish Ministry for the British and the Halifax government.
And one of the things, because we're almost out of time, Marty, one of the things that I stated before in our first conversation, for the record, 1327, for young people today, if you want to grasp an understanding of history, there are two events which are inextricably linked with one another. And you have to basically download the real history of both those two events. One of them is World War II, and the other is the assassination of President Kennedy. The two events are inextricably linked, and one of the most egregious of those links was Prince Max Eggen von Hohenlohe. Very quickly, Monty, there are links at the top of each written food for thought description and each written for the record description and each food for thought post for links which will enable you to A, subscribe to the podcasts being made by sister station WFMU, and also to obtain the 32-gigabyte flash drive with all of my life's work on it, and I get no money whatsoever from either of those two things. So this concludes, for the record, program number 1332. Conversations with Monty, conversation number 6. This is being recorded on June 22nd of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying, thanks for listening.